Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriel Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Every day you spend on this earth, you're getting older.
I'm 7 years old.
I'm 28.
I am currently 29.
I'm 32.
I'm 33.
I'm 42.
I am 47.
Fine, I'm 60.
I'm 61.
I'm 72.
I'm 76.
78.
And as you age, your body is changing.
The normal changes start really at the head, and they work all the way down to your toes.
I noticed my first gray hair.
So I first noticed lines on my face.
I'm not quite as nimble as I used to be.
There's changes in ability to see certain colors. There's changes in hearing and the ability to discriminate sounds.
Huh?
You need more of a sensation to feel anything, see anything, taste anything, hear anything.
And then there are the many aches and pains.
I'm more and more like a rotting banana.
When I start making noises when I first get up out of a seat.
Sleeping wrong, absolutely a thing.
Not being able to play sports the way I used to.
When you wake up in the morning and you're already tired.
In a way, our bodies are like a car piling on miles.
The parts sort of wear down. Sometimes we can replace them, but sometimes we can't.
That's Barbara Resnick. She's a geriatric nurse practitioner.
Our bones thin, and you get some compression in your spine, and we all shrink a little bit. You're not going to grow with age. You're definitely going to shrink. And there's also some changes in fat movement. And all of the fat in our body tends to go to the center.
So far, none of the things we've talked about sound all that appealing. So we tend to see aging as a negative, and I like to joke, well, it beats the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
But we do see it as a negative, right? A lot of times.
So many people do see aging as a negative, and I always like to think about the things that are, in fact, very positive about aging. Number one, I will tell you, with age, I think, comes more of a feeling of freedom in that, you know what, if you don't like what you're looking at, then just don't look. The other thing that comes with aging that no one can change is accrued knowledge. Knowledge and experience that you just can't get when you're 20, 30, or even 40.
Best thing about aging is the amount of wisdom I have now.
Maybe you feel a little more centered, a little more confident.
There is more flexibility.
The older I get, the realize that I'm always happy.
I look forward to cutting in line, and then they're like, let her go. She's 82. What are you gonna do?
If we're lucky enough to stick around, aging will happen, and it's not all bad. On today's episode, we'll look at how we want to age, what's important to us, and what gets in the way. Let's start with a story about mental health. That can certainly take a dip as people get older. Liz Tung has been looking into mental health issues among Chinese seniors. Hey, Liz.
Hey, Maiken. So there's new research from the population study of Chinese elderly. It's one of the biggest epidemiological studies on Chinese seniors ever done in a Western country.
So those are Chinese people living in the U.S.?
Right. And I talked to the lead researcher. His name's Xingqi Dong. He works at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And he says what they found about the mental health of Chinese seniors really surprised him.
Tremendous amount of depression, anxiety, sense of hopelessness, stress, as well as suicidal ideations from the data that we collect. Some of those numbers are much higher than we anticipate.
Why was he surprised? What part of this did he not anticipate?
So there's been this kind of popular idea that Asian seniors are better off because of this cultural value called filial piety. It's a concept that comes from Confucianism, started in China, and it puts a really strong emphasis on adult children really revering and taking care of their parents.
You're respected, you're loved, your kids are taking care of you, and all of that protects your mental health and well-being.
Right, exactly. But researchers like Xingqi say there's also a flip side. For instance, they found that Chinese seniors who don't receive filial piety are really a lot worse off. And that's something they've been seeing here in the U.S. with adult children who don't grow up with these ideas of filial piety.
So do the researchers think that this disconnect between expectations and what's actually happening could be contributing to high rates of mental health issues among older Chinese people?
Yeah, so Xingqi told me that definitely seems to be a big factor in what they're seeing. But he said another problem that seems to be compounding that is that a lot of older Asian people aren't going out to get help. And he says that's because there is a lot of stigma and misinformation around mental health issues in Chinese culture.
There's a great shame and misbelief that are associated with having mental illnesses. There are many sayings in Chinese that people don't want to air their quote-unquote dirty laundry to others.
So it sounds like there is a need for mental health treatment, but people are not seeking it out.
Yeah, so I was looking around to find out if anybody is working on this problem, and I connected with a reporter in New York. His name's Jad Slayman, and he recently found a senior center in Flushing, which is this heavily Chinese neighborhood in Queens, that's trying out a creative solution to the problem. And what's really cool about it is their solution doesn't fight against traditional Chinese ideas. It works with them to connect people with mental health treatment. So Jad headed to a place called the Self-Help Senior Center to find out more.
This senior center is bursting with activity. Older New Yorkers, most of them Chinese, stop in for a meal, computer classes, or just to socialize. In one room, two dozen or so Asian seniors practice Tai Chi. Elsewhere, members sing and play traditional Chinese instruments as they rehearse a type of opera. But Jane Chu, the program director here, tells me the seniors weren't always so engaged.
And some members, when they came here, is so sad and just crying. And now they are just involved into all the activities, smiling. You can see the faces here. Just fewer couch potatoes.
That's 66-year-old Yu Fen. She used to be one of those couch potatoes Jane mentioned, spending her days sitting by the wall, watching others go by.
I felt like I couldn't find the power to keep living. I would sit on that bench outside with tears rolling down my cheeks. I didn't want to eat, couldn't sleep.
Yu Fen moved to Flushing, Queens 2 years ago, from Beijing. Growing up, she was the eldest of three siblings by 10 years. Her parents died very young, and she took care of her brother and sister, never starting a family of her own or marrying. So when she retired, she figured she'd come to New York, where her sister was working long hours as a health aide. Yu Fen thought she could help out around the house to make things easier for her sister and her brother-in-law, but that's not how things worked out.
After living with my younger sister and brother-in-law for a while, I started to feel like something wasn't right. I'd been doing so much for them around the house, but I started to feel like I wasn't welcome. I had always thought that they needed me, but now suddenly it occurred to me, my family doesn't need me.
Yu Fen felt she was getting in the way, unwanted.
I had no confidence. It was like, what kind of life was I waiting for? I once got so angry, I just said, I would rather die than go back to them. I'd rather die than go back. I started feeling like I was in a swamp, like I would drown if I didn't find a way out.
That's when Yu Fen's sister started taking her to the senior center to cheer her up. There, Yu Fen saw a poster advertising a kind of skills training class.
I was hoping and praying for help. Then I was introduced to this teacher who was able to listen to the burdens in my heart.
Notice Yufen doesn't use the word counselor or social worker. She says she met a Lao Shur, teacher, and that's by design. Officials with the New York City Department of Aging had learned early on that putting up basic ads for mental health services, therapist on site, Tuesday at 10, didn't work. There was too much stigma, too little familiarity among seniors, especially among Asian immigrants. So at the Senior Center in Flushing, they decided to try a specific kind of therapy that has roots in Buddhist teachings.
What I did was to translate Zen mindfulness practice into behavioral language.
This is Marcia Linehan, who developed an approach called dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT. In the late 70s, she was researching ways of treating highly suicidal patients. Many of them had a mental illness called borderline personality disorder. It's marked by unstable moods and low self-image. It's very difficult to treat since those suffering from it often perceive everything, even an attempt at therapy, as distressing criticism.
And they would either get angry at me, hide behind a chair, storm out, quit therapy.
She wanted her patients to identify damaging thought patterns and attitudes, but without becoming too distressed to continue therapy. And it was during a visit to a Buddhist monastery that Marcia had a light bulb moment.
Within days, I knew that I had found exactly what my clients needed. The basic message was all the time to try to radically accept everything. So it was this whole practice of just constantly, moment by moment, letting go of what you want and radically accepting what is.
This was the birth of dialectical behavior therapy. Acceptance of what's happening, accepting your own thoughts and feelings, that comes first. DBT also focuses on how to say no or ask for help, and learning emotional regulation, avoiding extreme sadness or anger.
Dialectical behavior therapy in form of treatment is really helpful because incorporate the mindfulness part, which a lot of seniors already practice, for example, Tai Chi or Qigong, so they already have the experience to be present at the moment, connecting with their inner feelings.
That's Yunyan Hu, a counselor at Self Help, the senior center in Queens. She's using DBT to help her clients, and she says, as a Chinese person, a lot about DBT sounds pretty familiar. For instance, what Linehan calls emotional regulation is also a Chinese philosophical idea known as walking the middle path.
Walking the middle path is actually a concept from Confucianism, which means it's like don't go to extremes. So, for example, people with emotional, they're in their emotional mind. When they're angry, they're going to act very extremely, like yelling at people or even arguing with people, or sometimes they can, for example, not taking care of their own health. So walking the middle path means you're combining your rational mind, your emotional mind, you're trying to find a way which is mostly effective for you.
Yufen, the woman who is having problems with her sister and brother-in-law, has been in treatment for almost a year now, and she says it's made a big difference.
As the process went on, I slowly underwent a big change. It changed my whole mindset. I started to look forward to things, and my ability to control my moods became stronger.
She says she doesn't feel so hopeless these days.
I may be old, but as the proverb says, do not believe it is night when the sun has only dipped behind the mulberry trees. There is still the afterglow of the sunset.
Yufen is still living with her family, but getting out a lot more now. She's found someone who does need her, an older woman she looks after part-time as a home aide, and she's started taking English classes.
Yes. I have to take care of nearly 90 old women, yes.
How old are you? How old are you?
I?
Yeah.
I'm 66.
66.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Not very old, I think. I can do a lot of things.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
The interview with Marcia Linehan that we heard in Jad's piece is from a YouTube channel. It's called Borderliner Notes. It explores borderline personality disorder. As we try to navigate aging, some of us find people we look up to, who are ahead of us in the yearbook of life. For writer Ben Yagoda, that person is Terry Britt. Terry is in his 70s, Ben is in his 60s. They both volunteer at an arboretum, pruning, trimming trees, weeding. Ben likes that Terry stays active and that he's an avid runner.
You run every day?
Every day.
And
unless it's pouring rain, yeah. Now or we've got over 3 inches of snow in the winter. Even during the winter, I run.
How many miles do you typically run a day?
Probably 6-7 miles. Rather than inactive, I'd like to die last day of activity in my life.
Or while running?
Yeah, so find me along the road and I wonder. I don't have ID with me, so they'll have to figure out who I am. So that would be my ideal way to die, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, not to get heavy, but as we age, the idea of death becomes something that's in our minds. I mean, what do you think about that?
It doesn't bother me at all. No, I said, okay, I just want to go as long as I can, and everybody's going to die, so I just want to die a nice death. Along the road, so,
yeah.
And just drop.
That's Terry Britt talking with Ben Yagoda. Today's show is about aging, how we want to get old, and what gets in the way. One major factor that can put a damper on healthy, active aging is our bones. They get thinner and weaker with age. Millions of people develop a condition called osteoporosis. It can lead to fractures and other injuries. Endocrinologist Farah Khan treats patients with bone health issues, but she also has a personal connection to this topic.
This really hit close to home when my grandfather had a very minor fall at home and fractured his hip because he had osteoporosis that we didn't know about, and he ultimately ended up bedbound for the remainder of his life. Then shortly thereafter, in the very same room where he had fallen, my grandmother, who had osteoporosis that we knew about that was just never addressed for 5 years by her doctor, also had a very minor fall and subsequently fractured her arm in 3 different places. Previously fully independent, she was now completely dependent on family members for all of her activities of daily living.
And how old were they when this happened?
My grandfather was 89. My grandmother is probably 86 or so.
And they were fine up until that fall?
My grandfather had been in and out of the hospital related to lung problems, but he was recovering up until that fall. My grandmother was healthy other than her chronic health issues that were being managed, and she was kind of aging as best as she could until this fall really set her back.
How do we test for osteoporosis, and when should we ideally do that?
So unfortunately, a lot of times people don't know they have osteoporosis until they suffer what's called a fragility fracture. A fragility fracture in and of itself is diagnostic of osteoporosis. And what I mean by fragility fracture is that you break a bone with some minor trauma. It could be a sneeze. You could have picked up your grandchild. And at that point, you have it, and you need to manage the fracture, and you also need to work with osteoporosis specialists to get osteoporosis treatment. To try to catch osteoporosis before you get to the fracture, you can use screening bone density scans because it's a silent disease. At the bottom line is that it's a silent disease, and often it doesn't really come to people's attention until a fracture happens. We have over 50 million Americans with low bone density, and this is at a cost of billions of dollars to the healthcare market, whether it's from fractures or treating osteoporosis itself.
What are some things I could be doing right now to prevent bone problems later on in life?
Eating a healthy diet, so fruits and veggies that are high in calcium and vitamin D. And also, if you're not getting your calcium from your food, you should supplement with dietary supplements. Stop smoking if you're smoking. Don't start smoking if you're not smoking. And then also just starting now, building in a regimen of resistance and aerobic exercise. So weight-bearing exercise is particularly good for bone health.
Could we do things to prevent falls in the first place?
Yes, this is really important. There is many things that you can do to prevent falls. You know, it can be something as simple as having non-slip mats in the bathroom, to, you know, getting rid of rugs that could be fall problems, to keeping things within close reach. And then on a more individualized level, if patients use walkers or canes for mobility, then they need to always be using those walkers and canes, because the one time that they're like, oh, I don't need to use it, could be the time that they fall.
How do you best balance the fear of falling and wanting to prevent that, and then also wanting to live your life? You know, my dad broke his hip riding his bike, which a lot of people said to him, well, why are you still riding a bike? But, you know, that's what he wants to do. So, and I understand that.
No, I completely understand, too. My own dad climbs ladders all the time in front of me, and it drives me nuts. But, you know, you have to let him live his life. But what I have done is I have encouraged him. I signed him up for a personal trainer. You know, you have to keep your strength up. Bone strength, muscle strength. These are also ways that if you can try to optimize what you can do and how to try to be best prepared to avoid that fall.
Farah Khan is a professor of endocrinology at the University of Washington. I have to admit that I was... How come endocrinologists do bone health?
So,
if I can admit my total ignorance here
for a second. No, of course. Endocrinologists, we are all the hormones in your body. And bone health is really impacted by, you know, your sex hormones, and you have parathyroid hormone. So yeah, that's why endocrinologists do bone health.
Oh, hormones. They get you when you're a teenager, certain times of the month, and then again when you're getting older. For women navigating menopause, fluctuating hormone levels can mean brittle bones, hot flashes, and mood swings. Hormone replacement therapy is one option, but the advice on this has been confusing. Are hormones life-extending or are they dangerous? A couple of years ago, Barbara Paulson, who is 59, decided to find out for herself.
This story starts with my love of dance and my fear of aging. I love Zumba, the Latin music, swinging my hips with a group of women. The last few years, though, my body started to feel so tired and heavy. When did this happen? With my arthritic feet and the 20 pounds I've gained, why is this so hard? The dancer in my head is so different from what I see in the mirror. There's gotta be something I can do.
All too often, the science.
Lately, these ads pop up on my computer that describe how I'm feeling.
Weight gain, insomnia, fatigue, lack of energy.
Okay, I don't have all of that, but yeah.
Hot flashes and more.
It's an ad for an anti-aging clinic that almost seems to know what's going on with me. And they even have a diagnosis, a lack of sex hormones. I'm a few years past menopause, no more periods, but I still have hot flashes, nothing I can't live with. I just feel like I'm aging faster. These days, the official guidance is not to take hormone drugs, unless your symptoms are pretty bad. But not that long ago, the advice was the complete opposite. So what happened? I called up my sister Kathy to help me remember what menopause was like for our mom. She'd stopped getting her period.
My memory is that she thought she was pregnant.
Right, and how did we know that?
I think I overheard her on the phone.
My mom was talking to her doctor.
And that's when we figured out how old she was, because we heard her say.
Right, because she was 40.
40. Because, you know, she was always secretive about her age.
Oh, God, yeah.
I remember us thinking, oh, maybe we'll have a baby brother, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
But my mother wasn't pregnant. She was 40 and going through what she called the change. Menopause is like the bookend to puberty. It's the body saying, okay, no more babies, the factory's closing down, which means it stops cranking out the estrogen you need to get pregnant. That loss of estrogen is just the natural aging process. But women didn't used to live so long. These days, when lots of us live past 80, that means we may spend close to half of our lives without estrogen. So my mom goes through menopause in 1966. That's the same year a gynecologist named Robert Wilson publishes this book called Feminine Forever. He says when women's estrogen dries up, they do too. And he offers a solution. If women are losing vitality, if they've run out of gas, all they have to do is top up their tanks with estrogen. It sounds way too simple, but in the 1990s, the science actually caught up with that advice, because all these studies started suggesting it could prevent heart disease, bone loss, even dementia. And not long after that, drug companies started talking directly to women. I remember this one ad in particular. It had Lauren Hutton, you know, that supermodel. She was getting older, but she was still pretty sexy, and she used that gap-toothed smile to try and convince women to start taking hormone replacement therapy. And by 2000, 15 million American women are taking it. But then, in July 2002, the National Institutes of Health calls a press conference in Washington.
Women should not start or continue this therapy to prevent heart disease. The findings show it doesn't work.
It's like, whoa, they're calling this huge study to a halt 3 years early? The study, called the Women's Health Initiative, was supposed to be the gold standard on whether women on hormones live longer, because estrogen protects against the number one killer of women, heart disease.
In fact, the therapy increases the risk for a heart attack or stroke. Additionally, it increases the risk for breast cancer and for blood clots.
That news in 2002, that hormone therapy increased the risk of breast cancer, sent millions of women running to their phones to call their doctor. The bottom line, women should get off hormone therapy now. There's more to that story, but first, let's talk about exactly what estrogen does in your body. It doesn't just affect a woman's reproductive organs. It triggers changes in your skin, hair, heart, bones, and your brain. I asked my friends Cynthia and Janet.
You wake up in the middle of the night and you're like sweating.
I would be weepy.
It's like soaking sheets.
And foul-tempered.
Dripping in sweat.
Depressive cycles that were pretty deep.
I would sometimes literally stick my head in the freezer.
My sister Kathy and I are noticing yet another symptom.
The other day, I was in the kitchen and all the dishes were cleaned up. And I said, God love that husband of mine. And I said, thank you for doing the dishes. And he looks at me and he goes, what? I go, wait, did I do them? I couldn't remember if I did them or not. Isn't that terrible?
Yeah. Oh, my God. I know. Swiss cheese brain.
My mother didn't take hormones. Neither did any of my sisters. And when I first hit menopause, I never considered it.
That kind of stuff scares me. I would have to have really severe symptoms for me to do it. I just worry about cancer and stuff.
She's not the only one. Ever since that 2002 study, the message continues to be hormone therapy causes breast cancer. And that frightens a lot of women. But what I found out is that message is wrong, because the findings from that study got distorted. Here's what happened. You have a drug that women take at menopause, typically around the age of 51. But instead of testing that drug on women in their 50s, most of the women in the Women's Health Initiative were in their 60s, 70s, even 80s. Why would that be? To find out, I called one of the study's principal investigators.
And I'm going to put you on speaker.
Robert Langer is an epidemiologist, and he says that study wasn't even about whether hormone replacement was a good idea for women in their 50s. Scientists already knew it was. Plenty of studies back that up. What they were trying to find out was whether women well past menopause, women 60 and older, should also get on the drugs.
To see if what we already thought was true for younger women would hold for older women.
And they found that hormones do not prevent disease in older women. And that's really important. But that's not the message that got reported.
And the headline of the press release said, major hormone study stopped for breast cancer harm. I saw that and I about blew up.
It turns out the increased risk of breast cancer was not statistically significant, but the media blitz was huge. Think about it. Breast cancer is the disease women fear most. So when headlines said hormone therapy increases that risk and causes heart attacks, Langer says that scared millions of women in their 50s off a drug that could have helped them live longer. A generation later, the science is clear. Women who start taking hormones near menopause actually lower their risks for bone fractures, dementia, and heart disease. But that news has been slow to trickle down to primary care docs. and slow to change the recommendations doctors give women. I've got one of the foremost experts on hormone therapy on the line, so you know I'm going to ask about my own situation.
I can't really give you clinical advice, but I can tell you sort of, you know, that sidewalk consult.
He says if you're within 10 years of menopause and you have hot flashes or thinning bones or some other reason to take hormones, you're in the clear.
You're certainly well within the envelope that there is no increased risk.
But since my symptoms are mild, he'd recommend hormones only if I had a family history of heart disease or osteoporosis or even dementia, which I do, 3 for 3. My father had a heart attack in his 50s, my sister had blocked arteries, and my mother developed osteoporosis and dementia and then died of heart failure at 83. When I talk to my own doctor, she agrees. Given my family history, getting on hormones might be a good idea in my case. But I have to monitor my risks, so I get regular mammograms and checkups, and now I've been on hormones for a year. And I feel good. And because I've also been eating less and lifting weights, I've managed to lose 20 pounds. I don't have any magical ideas that hormones are going to keep me young. I'm perfectly wrinkled for my age. But these days, as I salsa across the dance floor, I do feel a bit lighter in my feet.
Barbara Paulson reported that story. She has a podcast called Midway about navigating midlife transitions. Our hormone levels change as we get older, our bodies change, but our desires stay.
People tend not to touch people as they get older. And I find that older adults, especially those who are in different facilities, are like starving, you know, for intimacy.
That's Marion McCarthy. She's a geriatric nurse practitioner at Uyghur Mercy Living Center in Phoenix, Arizona. And she says the belief that older people are not having sex or somehow it's inappropriate is wrong.
So that term sexually inappropriate makes me just a little bit crazy, because we're defining things as inappropriate based on whatever, you know, whether they're our puritanical values or just the whole idea that women become neutered when we get older. You know, men, if they're sexual beings, they're thought of as dirty old men. We desire and engage in sex until well into our 80s and into our 90s. So the idea that as we get older that we don't need to, nor do we engage in sexual activity is just, it's a fallacy. And maybe it's because we're in this American culture where we really value youth and beauty and we don't think of ourselves, as sexual creatures as we get older. When I say we don't, I think maybe younger people don't think of older adults. If that younger person lives long enough, has the good fortune to live long enough, I believe that they'll think of themselves as a sexual being, regardless of how old they are.
Marion McCarthy is a geriatric nurse practitioner at Uyghur Mercy Living Center in Phoenix, Arizona.
Supporting the Pulse, the Coriell Institute for Medical Research, enabling scientific discovery around the world through its renowned collections of cell lines and DNA from the National Institute on Aging and National Institute for General Medical Sciences. Learn more at coriell.org.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about how we want to age and what gets in the way. Reporter Esther Honig has been documenting her father's cognitive decline ever since he was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease, and she produced this piece in 2015.
Do you know where you were born?
Yeah, I was born in San Francisco.
Okay. And what, do you remember what year?
I think it was 1452.
Hey, Dad, do you know what day it is today?
Yeah. January 19th, 1951. I was born in January 19th, 1951.
This is my dad, Jordan Honig, and for the last 4 or 5 years, he's been displaced in time.
Do you remember when you first started to get Alzheimer's?
I didn't get Alzheimer's.
You didn't?
No.
You could almost say he's a time traveler, because He slips through time and space. Sometimes you might even catch him in the present, but it depends, I guess. So for the past year, he's lived in a nursing home, and it's this tiny little corridor. It's the type of place where there's linoleum flooring and then fluorescent lights, and there's hardly any windows. It's the sort of place where the scenery never really changes.
And anything important that we should know about this year, 1951?
There really was a big wave. I was the first person to start creating things to eat. Everything I could think of that you would need to be in an ark.
Oh, this is the ark story.
Yes.
The story of the great ark.
Yes.
And then the tidal wave came. That was the tidal wave you were talking about earlier.
Yes, the tsunami.
And you had your ark built.
Yes, the ark was already built, and it's still running.
So he's talked about the ark before. I started documenting my dad around the time that he was diagnosed when he was 60. And he's had these reoccurring themes. And one of them is the great flood, or maybe sometimes it's a tsunami wave, and the ark. This is tape from him 4 years ago.
In your adolescence, you went to Israel too, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And we were looking at what was left of the ark. And in the ark, we found not just Israeli coins, but Bedouin coins.
He did actually go to Israel when he was out of college. But of course, finding the ark is a bit of an elaboration. But at different stages, he's been building the ark, or maybe he's been searching for the ark. But now he's progressed to sailing the ark. And it's this need to escape the impending tsunami, this wave that's going to come at him and crash down over everything.
It was a way of keeping alive, yes.
Seems like that's kind of what's happening in your head a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And as you got everything that you could onto mm-hmm. the ark,
and then
wave came.
They go,
That's Esther Honig with her father in 2015. Esther, how's your dad doing now?
So he's in the later stages of Alzheimer's at this point. He was diagnosed when I was 20, so it's been 8 years since his diagnosis, and that is really considered to be the later stages of the disease. He is not verbal. He's unable to communicate very much at all. He's highly dependent on other people to eat, to bathe, to get dressed. You know, the question that I always get when it comes to how is my father doing is, does he recognize you anymore? You know, that is far gone. His ability to even know maybe where he is on a daily basis or who he is, that's past him.
And how often do you get to see him? How far is he away from you now?
So I live in Greeley, Colorado. He lives with my mom and my sisters in Kansas City. And I'll be frank with you, I haven't visited my father in, I think I'm going on 2 years now. It's difficult to explain to someone who hasn't experienced that with their own father or with their own, you know, partner or loved one. It's not how I want to remember him. Since he has lost the ability to recognize me, to express emotion in any capacity, to communicate in any capacity, there's not a whole lot there for me to enjoy of him or for him to enjoy of me. And I tend to really hold on to the memories of who my dad used to be. I feel like I almost have to protect them against the state that he has digressed into. I want to remember my dad as best I can as a man who was very intelligent and charismatic and loving. And this just has so little to do with who my dad was.
Esther Honig is a reporter in Colorado. Her father is in a care facility, but many people who have Alzheimer's or dementia end up staying home and they have a family member who takes care of them. Maybe it's a spouse or a child. Sharon Wade from St. Louis is in her 50s and she takes care of her mother Martha, who is 87 and has dementia. Sharon told us how they spend their days and also about the challenges of caregiving.
I feed her breakfast and give her medicine, and then we'll walk from the front of the house to the back of the house. And then like twice a week, I try to bathe her, which can be challenging also. You know, I try to get her relaxed, and sometimes it goes over and sometimes it doesn't. So when it doesn't, I do not force it. Like if she just start, you know, really resistant, I just say, okay, we'll do it another day, you know. When we put this on the ottoman, move the hand. For the most part, we are in the living room. I'm interacting with her. Like she's a good speller. And, you know, I'll ask her words to spell. She can't communicate a whole lot, but she can definitely spell words.
Can you spell Baltimore?
B-A-L-T-I-M-O-R-E.
Okay.
And I've done it by myself for a long time, but I'm getting old also. I don't want to break nothing trying to catch her, or I don't want to twist something, you know, the wrong way. But when I was younger, I didn't think nothing about it. I just do it. And I'm learning, though. I'm learning to start letting people help me because it helps me as well. Socializing is one of the things that, you know, I had to give up. Shopping. I mean, I like shopping. I used to skate a lot, roller skate. Yeah, I kind of miss those things, but it ain't over for me. It's just time is just, you know, right now I can't do it. It's just a temporary thing.
You want some water?
Water.
You want cold water?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
She can communicate with me. Sometimes we'll actually hold a conversation, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, and we just talk like mother and daughter. And I'd be just so amazed because she's holding the conversation. And I'm like, wow, that's rewarding. Her being happy is basically my reward.
That's Sharon Wade. She takes care of her mother, Martha. Shayla Farzan of St. Louis Public Radio produced this piece. You're listening to The Pulse. We're talking about aging, and a lot of us feel some anxiety about this topic. Here is Barbara Resnick with a prescription for getting older with ease. She's a geriatric nurse practitioner.
So I think the best things to think about aging are to think about building your resilience. How are you going to cope with aging? How are you going to deal with the changes? Are you going to fall apart? Are you going to not be able to read the phone book anymore, if you can find a phone book, and get angry? Because if you're going to do that, you're not going to win aging. Being resilient means accepting the changes and optimizing what you've got to work with. If you get bad arthritis, instead of sitting down and crying and shaking your fists, you need to keep walking and keep moving and utilize interventions that help you manage the pain. Be able to ask for help appropriately and accept that help and go with the flow. It's a life process and you have to embrace it, enjoy it, eat well, particularly a high protein diet, and engage in physical activity and keep doing as much as you can do.
So you gotta fall in love with that old car.
Exactly.
Barbara Resnick is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing. To finish out today's show, we wanted to get a perspective from somebody who is a long way away from old age. Reporter Shai Ben-Yakov sat down with his son, Gil, who's 8.
Gil?
Yes?
What does it mean to you to get older?
I don't know. I actually never thought about that. It means to me that I'm able to do more things and able to do less things, too.
What do you mean, less things?
I mean, like, maybe when you're a kid, you can, like, go out and play baseball all the time with your friends at school. Well, when you're a grown-up, you have to go to work and actually work the whole day.
And what about, like, when you're even older than that, like an old person?
I don't know. I think when you're retired, you might want to go to a retirement home, which sounds better than not having a home.
How do you want to grow old?
Well, I want to live a happy life in good health and with a good family.
Do you think you'll feel different when you're an old person?
Oh, yes, I think I will feel.
How do you think you're going to feel different? These are hard questions.
I mean, they are. Once I'm past 21, I can drink, which actually, we might want to cut that part off.
What are you most afraid of as you get older?
I don't know. I think death is my fear. Can we change the subject? Like, sure. Can we not talk about dying?
Sure.
You're my dad. You're older than me.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
you could say a couple things.
I mean, what I can tell you is that when I was a kid, I thought that being older, like being a grown-up, was going to feel completely different. And I don't really feel completely different.
Oh, really?
I don't have quite as much energy as I did when I was a kid. But other than that, like, I don't feel very different.
Can I say something about the energy part?
Yeah.
Understandable. Very understandable.
That's Gil Ben-Yakov. He's 8. He was talking to his father, Shai. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. We had some reporting help this week from Kathy Ritchie at KJZZ in Arizona. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu and Liz Tung. This week, we have to say goodbye to Irina Zhurov. She brought us amazing stories from all over the world, Puerto Rico, Canada, and Russia, where she caught up with an American cowboy trying to teach Russians how to herd cattle.
All of a sudden, I hear this chi-ching, chi-ching, and I, what in the world? And I turn around. Here comes two guys riding over the hill behind us on bicycles. They thought they were going to help us move these steers with these bicycles.
We'll miss Irina, and we hope to hear stories from her new home in North Carolina. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.